From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about Delta 8 and the potential risks and benefits of the unregulated products. Then we'll learn about the Birth to 3 program and how it can support a child's development.
Research also suggests that the brain's development is the most adaptable in the first 3 years of life. And so early intervention services can change a child's developmental path.
Plus, we'll tell you about a book for young readers that's all about a wind turbine in Milwaukee.
I just started researching the wind turbine, asking questions and thinking about what a view it got, what it would see of the city and the port and the Great Lake, and what he might think and do standing over it all.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. How much thought have you given the wind turbine that's near the Hone Bridge in Milwaukee? I'm gonna guess not a lot, but one Milwaukeean was intrigued and set out to learn all about it, eventually writing a book. We'll speak with the author and tell you about the wind turbine later in the show. We'll start with this. Delta 8 products can be found all over Wisconsin, from dispensary businesses to even gas stations. The products have similar effects on a person to marijuana, which is still illegal in Wisconsin, but Delta 8 products aren't. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has spoken to over 100 people about their Delta 8 experiences. While some report the products are useful, others have reported illness, and there's been an increase in calls to poison centers. John Diedrich is an investigative reporter with the Journal Sentinel, and he joins Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to share more about Delta 8 products.
Can you help me make sense of, like, after so much debate about marijuana in the state for years, its little cousin Delta 8 is now in, like, every gas station, convenience store, and gift shop in the state?
It is confusing when people look at it. They think, you know, in Wisconsin, we've been discussing marijuana, specifically the legislators in Madison have been discussing it for years. For more than 10 years, it's been sort of in the discussion, and it hasn't advanced even to include medical. And yet, I think what people are surprised about, and really what I was as I got into the investigation, was Delta 8 and other products like it are all over the place. So, and they act very similarly to traditional marijuana. And these are in not only CBD stores, things that look very much like dispensaries that you see in legal marijuana states, but also gas stations and tourist shops and just all over the place. These items, they're psychoactive. So that means that they will do things. They will make you high, essentially. They're they're wholly unregulated in Wisconsin to the point where there isn't an age limit. Some stores are selling at 18, some are selling at 21. So it's really a wide open market that's sort of dropped into our state, even as marijuana is not legal here.
Yeah, the age limit thing kind of shocked me. We had talked about this, but I was on a road trip with my partner, middle of the state in the Driftless region. We're leaving like the farmer's market and heading into a tourist shop. This teen that worked at the shop was talking about these products that they had, and I was very curious about Delta 8, had never done it. And she was like, yeah, this is like a very easygoing one, and it kind of looks like a nerd's rope. So, you know, we have our lovely day in the countryside, come back, I have a little bit of the nerd's rope, and it was a terrifying experience where I was short of breath to the point where it was really difficult for me to breathe. My extremities started getting numb, and I just had this belief that I could breathe through it and that it wasn't going to be something that required medical attention because in those situations, there's not much you can do. And can we talk about what it is about Delta 8 that does concern people, including people that are in the industry?
Yeah, so in your experience, you're not the only one. One of the things that we've noted is the increase in the calls to poison center, as well as hospital visits. And that's not happening just in Wisconsin. Adults, but also children who are getting a hold of these products. So the process by which Delta 8 is extracted, basically it comes from hemp, and we can talk a little bit about how it is that this happened, but we call it the chemical cousin to marijuana, traditional Delta 9 marijuana. The difference is that in traditional marijuana states, the amount, the potency, and so forth is regulated. There's no potency oversight happening when it comes to Delta 8. So as an example, in Colorado, the maximum amount of THC in a edible is going to be 100 milligrams. So it'd be like 10 milligram pieces. There are products in the Delta 8 space and other hemp-derived products that are 2,500 milligrams.
That's wild.
And even if it's less, right, toe-to-toe, you're going up way beyond 25 times the amount. Now, there are also people, and I should point out, who feel like this has been super helpful to them. So it's come into a prohibited state like Wisconsin, and it's provided some things that traditional marijuana has provided in terms of relaxation and, you know, reducing anxiety in some cases and so
forth. Pain relief.
Yeah, pain relief, exactly, after working out, things of this nature. So I don't want to paint it as entirely negative. The caution that people have, I think, and people don't realize, they're like, well, if I can just buy this legally, somebody must be overseeing this.
Exactly what I thought.
And you're not alone. A lot of people are just assuming. And also, I think that we've been conditioned to think, specifically in CBD, that it doesn't do much. And CBD doesn't. It's non-psychoactive. So that means it doesn't get you high. But it does have some sort of relaxing elements to it. What Delta 8 is, and other hemp-derived products, is they actually come from CBD, and they're being sold alongside of CBD. So when people go in, and over the years, they've seen CBD, they've just said, well, that's no big deal. And then they might get another product that which is psychoactive and could be very high-potency psychoactive, and they get a lot more than what they bargained for.
You talked about the hemp market, which is something that I really didn't know that we had kind of this robust history with, which when I think about it in terms of having a robust hemp market in the state, also being an island of prohibition of marijuana, kind of sets up this perfect storm of having lots of products like Delta 8 that are unregulated, as you said. And it just got me thinking, what do we know about the hemp industry within the state, and what should we know?
When we say the hemp industry, we're talking about farmers to start with. And we're talking about farmers who have decided to, you know, dedicate part of their land to growing a product that was around back in the founding of this country. I mean, it's, you know, some of the comment will say, you know, founding fathers, that was sort of the original crop that was highly used at that point because it was so useful. What we've seen evolve since then is that there's a number of not only farmers in the state, in industry there, but there's also extractors and then refiners of the product and even labs that are doing the back-end testing. So we sort of have the whole ecosystem, but we don't really know how big it is, again, because there's no oversight. There's no part of Madison's government that's done anything. The agencies that were having oversight have basically handed that off to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but nobody's looking at licensing the derivative market. And the reason that's important is when to be able to derive these products, they're trace amounts in hemp. So you have to take a lot of hemp and use chemicals, acids, strong acids, and butane to distill this down. The problem with that is you can leave behind residuals in that, heavy metals, things of that nature. And, you know, as we talk to industries here in Wisconsin, there are manufacturers who very much want regulation. They themselves, they're manufacturers in this space, and they want some oversight because for them, they feel like they're doing, from the way they characterize it, a good job, a safe job, and a product that has been tested, and it's costly to do that testing and so forth. And they feel like there's a lot of less ethical and less credible players in the area.
I'm curious what you're hearing or what you've heard, how consumers view the product too. Because like you said, there are a lot of people who have had really good experiences with it, positive experiences with it in the absence of marijuana for things like pain relief and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we did this investigation, the Journal Sentinel did, in collaboration with The Examination, which is an international investigative organization that looks into health issues, and AL.com, which is in Alabama. So we did this together. We asked readers to reach out to us, and we've gotten more than 150 responses from people across the country about this. And it's really interesting to see the range, because there are people who are very strong advocates, you know, of Delta 8 and similar hemp-derived products who feel like, hey, I don't have to drive to Illinois or Michigan and, you know, risk a crime. This is legal and this is, you know, help me out. others who are telling scary experiences of, I mean, there was one guy I talked to who ended up actually in a temporary psychiatric hold. We don't really know what the what was in that product. And so I don't want to say like that's everybody's experience, but that experience is out there. I think what we're hearing from people is that those who have had good experiences or repeated experiences are telling me that there's a way to do this that is maybe to reduce your risk of overexposure or getting sick.
You had brought up earlier, too, that this was what they had done by unregulating Delta 8 is create an issue, a 50-state issue, broken down into Wisconsin is now a county-by-county issue. And I know I've heard of people kind of suggest, well, maybe this will get the ball moving legislatively to regulate marijuana, to have a full-throated conversation on what recreational legalization looks like. What do we know about where we stand there?
Well, so we did put a call out to many legislators. It was interesting how little interest there was in responding to this. And even the fact that there's been no bills compared to other states, no bills put forward at all by either Republicans or Democrats around the issue of Delta 8. And I think after talk, so I talked to Robin Voss and I talked to a couple other supporters of marijuana. Chris Larson was one of them and Melissa Apgar. Basically, the issue of Delta 8 seems to fall along traditional marijuana fault lines, if you will. So Robin Voss, Republican, most powerful Republican in the state, he supports a very limited medical marijuana. It was actually his bill that failed earlier this year. But he's very opposed to recreational marijuana. And he wants to see a discussion around banning Delta 8 and other products like it because he feels like this has been an end around to basically get recreational marijuana here. Whereas some of the supporters of medical and recreational marijuana feel like that should be legalized and Delta 8 should be brought up under the framework of that. And that, as Senator Larson said, you know, please have better things to do than sort of like chase a whole new class of products. And that makes some sense. And yet, you know, you have this sort of wildcat market that's out there. Are there some controls short of bringing it under a framework or full prohibition? So far, it seems like both sides are sort of staked out on and that this is really sort of held captive by the larger marijuana discussion.
After this conversation, I feel like I have more information on the product and its outlook in the state, but just as confused on how to carefully move forward. So I have something I'd like to do with you. Can we just set some safety guidelines for listeners who maybe are thinking about this or have approached this or have had negative experiences? Because as you've kind of hit on, there are safer ways to do this.
Mm-hmm. So I think you would start by where you buy. Are you buying in person? Are you buying online? We haven't talked about online, but there's a lot of online stuff that can come to you. You don't have a person to talk to. I think it's key, as I've talked to people in the industry, that you have somebody who you trust. You're probably not going to get that much in a gas station or places like that. And I'm not advocating, again, to be clear, any particular store or whatnot, but that's their thing. And it's in their interest to make sure that people don't have bad experiences because they want customers to come back as opposed to gas stations that are selling all kinds of different things. I would also look carefully at the package. One thing we haven't talked about is Delta 9. So a lot of people are seeing Delta 9 out there, which is confusing because, like, I thought that was illegal. The reason you're seeing Delta 9 is like Delta 8 and Delta 10 and so forth. It's one of the cannabinoids that can be isolated from hemp. And so the chemists have figured out how to isolate that as well. So people are going to see that when they go out there. And so what I think you want to do is look at the packaging, get a sense of what's in there, because a lot of them now are blended. They're not just Delta 8. There's Delta 9. There's HHC and Delta 10 and so forth. So talk to somebody who, you know, that's reputable that you're going to be able to return to. The other thing that people have said is start slowly, especially when you're talking about edibles. Because a little bit, and I know you didn't eat a lot yourself, but I've heard people say, like, I started and then I didn't feel anything. And after half an hour, it took more. And then you're on an experience that could go for a long time in an unpleasant direction.
John, thank you so much for coming in and sharing everything that you've learned. And we look forward to where the investigation goes from here.
Thanks, Jimmy. Really appreciate it.
John Diedrich is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez, and you can find a link to his reporting at WUWM.com. Raising kids can come with many challenges, and if parents are in need of extra support, the Milwaukee County Birth to Three program is a local resource. It's an early intervention program that addresses developmental delays and disabilities. The goal is to enhance a child's development with the help of educators, therapists, and service coordinators. To learn more about it, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Samantha Cortez, the Birth to Three program coordinator for Milwaukee County, and Crystal Vang, Milwaukee County's Birth to Three liaison. Vang begins by explaining what makes the period between birth and age three so crucial for a child's development.
Every child learns and grows at their own pace, right? But there are milestones that every child should meet. And so parents and caregivers, they know their child best. And it's best when, you know, we can interact with them positively to impact the child and their development. And so research also suggests that the brain's development is the most adaptable in the first 3 years of life. And so early intervention services can change a child's developmental path. So we can't emphasize strongly enough how important it is for early diagnoses and intervention so that we can help the family in any way with this process.
Okay, so let's say you're someone with a child who notices the maybe potential for some developmental delays or are concerned in general and don't really know where to start. What are the next steps?
If they have a concern, typically they can make a referral. We do receive about 3,000 to 4,000 referrals a year. And so, you know, the impact that the Birth to Three program has on Milwaukee County, it's large. And we have also great partnerships with, local community hospitals and clinics and school districts, also with the Division of Milwaukee Child Protective Services, to name some of the few. So making a referral is the best way to do that. And by doing so, you can call the referral line. Do you know it, Samantha?
414-289-6799.
So then to call the referral line would be the best way. And then behind that phone call, there's a professional that is there to receive the call so that they can answer the questions and concerns and direct them appropriately.
Samantha, can you touch upon what evaluators look for when assessing a child and before kind of determining next steps and working with the family?
Yes. So our motto in Birth to Three is primary coach approach to teaming. And so that means that we really take the family's input. They know their child best. So we're really looking for that parent's knowledge on what is going on with their child. We look at the overall development of the whole child. And if there's a specific concern, then we look at that specific concern. So the family has an option of evaluators from speech therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists that can look at that specific development with their specific tool and their expertise.
There are a lot of factors that come into play when it comes to assessing and offering the correct services. And Milwaukee County is still in an unfortunate place where race plays a big factor in predicting health outcomes. And research indicates children of color are more likely to be misdiagnosed or diagnosed later in life. So how is the Birth to Three program working to address this and try to create an inclusive environment for children and their families to address them according to what works best for them?
Yeah, so in the past 2 years, we've had the opportunity to receive grants that focus on different aspects. So one, focusing on that social and emotional development, so that mental health of the caregiver and that child, as well as our current grant is focusing on eliminating barriers. So having being more access, raising more awareness to families that don't know about early intervention or might not know about child development and what their child's milestones should be meeting. So that is our goal, is trying to really eliminate those barriers, being more accessible to children and families of color, especially our Latinx and our Asian families. Our data really shows that we're not receiving those referrals as increasingly compared to white peers.
I imagine this has a lot to do with outreach challenges. Can either one of you speak on that aspect of your work?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the whole pandemic and the COVID-19 pandemic, we actually this our grant that we did for that social emotional development, our efforts, we had to change our efforts. We wanted to do more, you know, in-person outreach, going to the neighborhoods and communities. And with that pandemic, we had to switch gears. So we did a lot of our outreach social media wise. We launched our Facebook page and we did more community cafes. So having more of those opportunities for families to just click on a team Zoom link to get to know the Birth to Three program, wherever they're at any time, they can join us that way. So we trialed that out and it was really successful that we were able to get a lot of families interested in a virtual world and learning about the Birth to Three program.
In addition to these outreach challenges, I imagine that sometimes it's hard for parents to overcome their own conflicted feelings about asking for help or not knowing what's next for their child and even the stigma associated with that. So what would you like to share with caretakers to encourage them to take advantage of services like Birth to Three?
I would say parents know their child the best. And it's okay to ask for help. And we are not here to judge families or to let you parents know this is what your child should be doing. But we work individualized with that child and that family and letting them know where they're at developmentally. Our program is voluntary, so we are not mandated to provide these services, but we are here to help. And any little questions, any little concern, wondering, is my child supposed to be doing this? We're here to help answer those questions.
Parenting is hard and can be isolating too. What kind of community or support network has stemmed from Birth to Three that you both have seen?
I would say that we've had the opportunity to work with the parenting network in the past 2-3 years in providing specific parenting classes and trying to increase our family engagement and building a sense of community in Birth to Three. We had an event Friday, May 19th at the zoo for our Birth to Three families, and we had over about 400 families attend and just got to know and get to interact with other families who are facing the similar challenges. And it was really great and nice to see that.
Crystal, could you talk about any other positive impact on families in Milwaukee County that the Birth to Three program has seen?
Yeah, for sure. So then we also with the parenting network, we had what was called the FAST classes. And so that's an 8-week series, once a week for 8 weeks. And this is a time where families can come together and have a meal together and also spend some quality time with their child. Also, they get to separate from their child and then be able to meet with the adults that are in the group and have some conversations with other parent partners. So with that, we're building the community that is much needed in this population, you know, with young children, because again, you know, every child learns differently and every parent also parents a little bit different. So being able to come together to unify, you know, that community, that support for each other, just to know that they're not alone in this and that, you know, even though you're taking your own path, you're also walking alongside other people and peers that are going through the same things.
So this program is Birth to Three. I'm wondering, do you guys also serve a connective role in continuing a family support network after 3 years old?
In the Birth to Three program, we transition families to school services and other programs outside of Birth to Three. At the time that they turn three or right before they turn three, that is, you know, when we start the process for transition out of the program. And so we do work in partnership with other community providers, and we usually recommend an LEA, which is a local education agency referral to school services if they should need additional support after they turn three.
Great to know. So before we close out, let's remind people, what's the best way for someone to connect with Birth to Three to start?
The best way that somebody can reach us is by calling the Milwaukee County Children's Program and Intake and Referral Line at 414-289-6799.
All right. Well, Samantha and Crystal, thank you both so much for sharing more about Birth to Three.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Samantha Cortez is the Birth to Three Program Coordinator for Milwaukee County. Crystal Vang is Milwaukee County's Birth to Three liaison. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. If you've driven over the Hone or paid attention to the southern shore of Lake Michigan, you may have noticed a wind turbine over the water. It's the inspiration for a book for young readers, and we'll tell you all about it in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll meet Milwaukee's first public artist in residence. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Sarah Davitt is Milwaukee's first public artist in residence, a position created by the city in 2023 to address civic challenges in Milwaukee with creative, artistic ideas. Davitt has designed an art car, a truck rescued from a municipal tow lot that features carvings of Milwaukee landmarks, traffic cones, and messages about traffic safety. The art car will debut this summer, popping up at locations around the Milwaukee area to spark discussions about reckless driving. Lake Effect's Sam Wood sits down with Davitt to discuss the art car and her goals for the project.
Can you talk about your work as the artist in residence and on the art car and what you hope people get from your creation?
So the general art car came across a lot of my experience with the Burning Man community. Art cars are actually how you get around out there, as aside from foot and bicycle traffic. And so having a lot of those ideas in the back of my head about mobile solutions for mobile problems. So if something is happening all over the city, how can you address that with a single mural in one place? How can you address that with a sculpture in one place? So how do you make a piece of art mobile? How can you set up that path to success for a solution that has the most impact over the greatest collection of populations? So I started with the idea of just covering this car in traffic cones and have later moved into carving the buildings of Milwaukee and the landmarks of Milwaukee onto these cones. So we have North Point Tower, we have the Basilica, we have a cone dedicated to River West 24, we have... the bronze fawns is on there, as well as the P&H shovel out near the Miller Park. And then also we're carving the abandoned gas station on Wisconsin and 25th. There's things that people use to navigate the world, and they don't necessarily correlate directly to the skyline of Milwaukee. Yeah. And so the top of the car is going to be sort of all of these buildings rising out of sort of the lake. So we have the Hone Bridge on the front, and we have... the beach is on the side, so it is a moving city by a lake. And while the proposal was about reckless driving, I prefer to talk about driving safety and driving skill rather than the alienation of the term reckless, that it is very othering. It is very, it also allows you an excuse to sort of back out of that conversation because it's not about you.
Yeah, like I'm not a reckless driver. That's everyone else, right?
Totally safe as I'm texting down the road and eating a sandwich at the same time. What does that look like? So anyway, how do you bring some of that? How do you bring some of that conversation to all the people in kind of the middle, who almost all the people who have to deal with driving challenges and on the road, is that there are people who are genuinely reckless. And we have, there's people who would never answer the question, I am reckless. So if you've come at a vehicle person in a vehicle, and you say, bikes rule, cars drool, or whatever that is, or, you know, you should just get off the road, nobody likes you anyway, or, you know, we're just going to shut down all your roads, don't worry about it, it's fine. You know, like, what is that conversation going to do to that person? They're not going to want to talk to you again.
Yeah.
They're not going to care what you have to say.
Right.
Even though you may have the common ground. And in talking to a lot of the folks in the vehicle community and doing a lot of social media reviews, how do you look at those conversations in ways that say their common ground is, can we just not kill people today? That would be great.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, I don't want to kill people. I have never wanted to kill someone in my life.
Yeah, it sounds like the art car is meant to be the vehicle for conversation around, like, all right, how can we be better, and how can we each take a small step to being a better driver that hopefully adds up to safer roadways.
Right. And so it's, you know, how can you be a better driver? How can you be a better pedestrian?
Mm.
How can you behave in a way that is more predictable? Mm. Because it is the covenant of predictability that allows the road systems to operate the way that they do, with the reliability and functions that they do. If there isn't that predictability, if you are not operating within the general cultural norms of the space that you are moving through, will you cause people to have even tension, or just, you know, if you're deciding that you're in charge of the scenario, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that go? So,
yeah. Well, tell me about how your interest in this topic has evolved over time, because I'm guessing it wasn't you sent an application in to be artist in residence and then just started thinking about, you know, reckless
right.
driving, traffic safety.
Right.
So how has this evolved for you over time?
So some of the evolution comes from my involvement with the bicycle community out of Boston, specifically the Skull Bicycle Chopper Gang, the Subversive Choppers Urban Legion. They were chopping out bicycles and riding around in a phenomenal sort of moving community.
Mm-hmm.
They had radio stations that broadcast to other ships in the fleet because they're huge nerds, and
yeah.
that's delightful.
That's a fun thing to know about,
yeah.
you know, biker gangs, is they're truly in their heart of hearts, huge nerds.
Exactly. So we were building choppers. We were riding them every Saturday. They've been doing it for at least 30 years now,
mm-hmm.
Which is phenomenal. And also I was bicycle commuting every 6 years out there in the winter. Everything, all of that was being done. So I have a lot of bicycle perspectives, but then also my dad was a race car driver and also got heavily into motorcycles. So I remember being a young person, and he gave me a movie called On Any Sunday. And there was basically an entire blooper reel of that communicated why it was important to wear leathers, because you showed so many motorcyclists crashing
yeah.
and then skidding in a way that they were able to walk away from.
Mm.
And then also, you know, one of his big driving lessons for me was to take me out on a sheet of ice in the back parking lot and say, turn the wheel all the way to the left and now step on the gas. And when you feel like you're going to vomit, get out of it.
Jeez. Okay.
But that's a skill. Yeah. You have to learn to countersteer.
Yeah.
And you have to learn to kind of let... not freak out and slam on the brakes, or not freak out and slam on the gas. And that skill has stayed with me. You know, sometimes there's different ways you are driving a giant machine, and that is a skill.
Mm-hmm.
That is a skill that requires awareness, it requires engagement, it requires attention, it requires sometimes a lighter touch than you might normally. If you kind of hold on too tight, you think you're controlling it, but you're actually the most out of control you could be.
How have these travels and conversations that you've had with people having to do with driving and transportation, and then, of course, your own driving lessons,
mm-hmm.
How have they helped you in this process of bringing people along with the ARCAR project?
So a good chunk of the most recent 10 years of my life has been operating in social change spaces and international development spaces. And so how do you understand that sometimes the relationships and the process is more important than the outcome of the product,
mm-hmm.
of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you build those relationships so that those messages land in a softer, more receptive place?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get people to believe in your work who aren't your mother? You know, how do you get people to be open and receptive to the conversation? And sometimes that is by bringing in something that is completely ridiculous. This project will be ridiculous and delightful and amusing and hopefully insightful. And the conversations, I hope, will be more inclusive than I might normally expect.
Talk more about that approach and, as you say, kind of, you know, it's supposed to be ridiculous. You know,
mm-hmm.
the Milwaukee Magazine piece quotes you as saying that that this approach of using art to address, you know, reckless driving and traffic safety stands in contrast to punitive measures like fines and speed bumps. Why is this balance and this, you know, as you say, like ridiculous approach
mm-hmm.
important?
So when you talk about people who have sort of lived with a tremendous amount of trauma from loss, from fear, from just general tension from walking through the day, I spoke to one person who said, I'm feeling this road, and I'm feeling just the tension and anger that's coming from this road. Mm-hmm. And I kind of said, hold up, we have to sort of unpack that a little bit and think about what would that do to your ability to navigate this road effectively? If you approach your environment, your neighborhoods, your space with fear, what does that mean? How do you get people who are feeling as if, because their neighborhoods are dangerous, how do they get from A to B as fast as they can? How do they get from there in a way that allows them to feel in control of this one thing that they normally might not feel in control of anything else in their life? That if they can't control their income, their money, their housing, their situation, all that thing, in this moment behind this wheel, I'm in control of this one thing. So how can you bring some of that message and alleviate that fear with a sense of skill and an attentiveness to how that all can make us all better drivers, or even just conflict management? Because if you see someone behaving poorly on the roads, you will find people who will like try and like cut you off extra just to prove you were wrong, or teach you a lesson, or do something like that, when really the proper response is just let it go. If you feel unsafe, exit the road until you feel safe again.
Yeah.
You know, how can you teach that? That's a skill.
Yeah.
To recognize that this situation is unsafe and I am completely and totally within the agency to leave that situation.
Yeah, it is easy in the moment, or the easy answer in the moment, if you get cut off or just feel wronged on on the streets, is to let them know that you've been wronged. And I think like that's a natural response, is saying like, hey, you know, wanting to communicate that you've been that you're upset in some way. But yes, when you're talking about it, you're on the road and you've got, you know, these however many thousand pound machines that are, you know, talking to each other and not, you know, actually speaking to each other, maybe the best approach is, as you say, kind of taking a moment and just saying, you know what, that has passed. What do we do now? So I want to close with what's next? When and where can we see this? Can we see this art car in action?
So you should definitely keep an eye out for it this summer. Hopefully it will attend block parties. Hopefully it will attend even just kind of casual conversations. Just park down by the lake and let people come to those conversations and engage with the piece and find all the Easter eggs and the secrets that I've been buried into the whole project.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Sarah Davitt is the City of Milwaukee's first public artist in residence. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Coming up, we'll tell you about a book for young readers that was inspired by a Milwaukee wind turbine. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. A picture book brings to life a very special wind turbine in Milwaukee. You've probably seen it before, on the southern shore of Lake Michigan by the Hone Bridge. Milwaukee author and educator Katie Meyer wrote a book for young readers called Gust. That's her name for the little wind turbine who wants to help his community, but doesn't know how. Meyer speaks with WUWM's Lena Tran about the turbine and her book.
Take a drive on the Hone Bridge and you can't miss it. The small lone wind turbine on the south end of the bridge right by the lake. When she first moved to Milwaukee 5 years ago, Katie Meyer noticed it too, and she couldn't get this little wind turbine out of her head. She named him Gust. Gust E. Day. This is what Gust sounds like close up. Kind of like someone's hair is getting brushed over and over. Meyer told me about how her fixation on the wind turbine started, and how it became Gust, the book.
When I moved to Milwaukee and bought a house in Bayview around 2018, the wind turbine is unavoidable. I mean, I would take my dog for walks by the lake, when I went to the farmer's market or beer garden at South Shore, even on my commute to work over the home bridge, I just kept seeing the wind turbine. It was everywhere. So for those of you who haven't seen it, though, the wind turbine stands alone. It's not in a wind farm like most wind turbines that I've experienced, kind of out in a rural, very large field area. And it is smaller than any wind turbine I've seen previously. In fact, it's less than half the size of most average wind turbines. And it's in the middle of the city, which is very unusual to me, and I think unusual for wind turbines, and also right on the shore of Lake Michigan. So it just really stood out to me as part of our Milwaukee skyline. And then no one was talking about it. Uh-huh. I was so surprised as someone new to the area. And maybe it's because I came from Washington, D.C., which is a city of memorials and monuments. But it was such a standout feature to me about the Milwaukee area. And I thought it deserved as much attention as, like, our Hone Bridge or our Clock Tower or the Milwaukee Art Museum and all these other great features that I was learning about my new city and also seeing kind of photographed and depicted. And then I myself was new to a city with few friends at the time. Mm-hmm. COVID hit almost, well, very soon after when we moved into our new home. So there was like a lot I couldn't do to explore and get to know Milwaukee.
Sure.
Or meet people. Maybe I can blame COVID isolation for why I characterized and named a wind turbine and started talking to it. But fortunately for me, I had one friend in the city who actually just became the new port director at Port Milwaukee at the time that I was thinking about this and researching and writing. And I learned that that wind turbine I'd been seeing stood on Port Milwaukee grounds. So I had at least one other person who felt as passionately about this wind turbine as I was beginning to feel, and I just really wanted to tell its story.
That's so cool. Well, so you had these questions about this wind turbine, mm-hmm. which anyone would recognize. Did you just happen to ask your friend, like, oh, do you know about this turbine because it's near the port? Or, like, how did you make that connection?
Yeah, I think I was starting to talk about it. I got curious, asked questions, and as I was kind of seeing the wind turbine, I kept thinking about what it might see from this great vantage point over a busy working port. I had never lived in a city that had like an active working port. And so the book was always from the wind turbine's perspective in my mind. So I just started researching the wind turbine, asking questions and thinking about what a view it got, what it would see of the city and the port and the Great Lake, and what he might think and do standing over it all. As I learned, I was amazed at how much the wind turbine did for the port and for our city. And the people at Port Milwaukee have been so gracious in answering all my questions and championing their little wind turbine. And I am an educator. I'm in education myself. And so I always kind of think about children's literacy. And so that was in the back of my brain. And so I started to research books that already exist and learned that there are very few fictional books or stories about wind turbines, and especially for younger children, and none that I've been able to find that have a wind turbine as sort of an anthropomorphized character, especially the main character.
Uh-huh.
So I learned a lot researching Gust, and as I learned more, I just really wanted to make it come to life. And also, the timing was right. Mm-hmm. I mean, climate conversations are happening more and more at the table, right, at the dinner table. We're all experiencing, like, the massive and often dangerous impact on our world and changes in our world. So it just felt really urgent and important to share. And I, like I said, I'm in education, so it might not come as a surprise, but I really believe that children are the future of climate justice and that they need to grow up knowing more and doing better than we are. Not that we as adults can opt out. We're not off the hook. I thought Gust could be a child-friendly introduction to wind energy and an entry point for parents and educators to talk to kids about renewable energy sources, mm-hmm. starting with our very own success story.
Absolutely. Can you say more about what you mentioned, like, Gust was doing so much for the port? What is the role that this turbine plays in the Port of Milwaukee?
Yeah. I have learned a lot, but I always want to say I am an author and educator first, not a wind turbine or wind energy expert, because sometimes I get questions and I'm like, I'm not actually sure. But I have learned a lot, and some of the things that I've learned, City of Milwaukee's Environmental Collaboration Office, or ECO Office, and Port Milwaukee installed our wind turbine in 2012. So Gus turned 11 this year. That wind turbine is 100 kilowatts and is 154 feet tall, which is about half the height of most average wind turbines. But it has already far exceeded the initial estimates in clean energy production and savings for our city. So kind of a twofold thing that it does. First, it provides the port's headquarters administration building with over 100% of its electricity needed, making it the first Milwaukee city building to be a net zero electric energy user with clean renewable energy. So it's very exciting.
That's so cool.
Not only does it power the port's headquarters building, but it actually produces enough wind energy to sell some back to the city's power grid. And so it can power up to 18 average Wisconsin homes a year, like yours or mine or your listeners. And so it has both an environmental and an economic benefit. And the savings on the city's electric bill since the installation has been about $200,000 across the last 10 years.
That's amazing.
It's huge, right? Yeah. And people aren't talking about it. So it also creates revenue for the city each year. It actually creates about $8,000 in revenue per year on average.
Well, I love that you created this little superhero for us. I think that's the thing that I love. You know, it's so recognizable. And he really is this like powerhouse little wind turbine. Yeah. It's very fun to see him come to life with all the other characters on the shoreline, whether it's the lighthouse or the bridge. Does thinking that way come naturally to you, like seeing them as characters?
I think so. I think I've always been a book lover and a book reader. I was an elementary educator, still work in education. And so I see the world, I think, in a lot of stories. And so as I was thinking about this character, I just sort of started characterizing everything else that it would see. And I know that kids enjoy things that move, things that go, right? So seeing things like trains and boats and trucks would help make it feel more accessible and relevant to kids. And then introduce this character, this idea of a wind turbine and wind energy and how it works as sort of a primer for renewable energy.
So all this stuff, all the goings-on at the port, all the things, all the goods that go in and out, and all the different modes of transportation, is that stuff that you knew about? Or is it like, I'm curious, I'm going to like hit up my friend and figure out what actually goes on there?
I am so embarrassed to say that as a full-grown adult, I had very little idea of what the port does. I had never lived in a city that had a working port, so I had to ask a lot of questions about it. And I also hope that kids will learn a little bit about it. There's some, you know, kind of academic vocabulary like cargo and port that are thrown into the book for kids to experience and learn and get some background knowledge on, so that when they're a grown adult, they have more understanding than I did.
And when you decided that you wanted to make this book, how did you move from having the character Gust E. Day is his full name.
Yes. I wanted to throw something in there for parents to be able to giggle at, too.
I'm sure parents appreciate that. But so how do you move from that character to the central like narrative of the book, this problem that he has, which is that Gust wants to help, but he doesn't know how?
Yeah, he feels really stuck being a wind turbine that is literally stuck into the ground and sees everybody else moving around him in this busy port, whether it's people or the other characters. And then sort of the solution is actually a change in Gust himself, realizing that he also has a job to do. And so that's part of what I hope kids and parents take out of the story or take away from it. There's these ideas of community and belonging and friendship that actually can really resonate with kids around this age, too.
That's sweet. You have taught kids with so many books, you know, as a teacher and educator. So I'm sure that you have many favorites and your own ideas about what makes a really wonderful book for kids. What did you want to bring to life in your own book? This is your first.
Yes, it is my first. I really wanted it to be engaging. I wanted it to be something that kids would be interested in returning back to. I've really loved the stories that I've gotten from families, parents, classrooms, even when they're like, my kid keeps asking to read your book over and over, and, you know, I'm like, sorry. But I wanted to be something that really spoke to kids, whether it was sort of the lesson, knowing that we all have different jobs to do, different skills, identities, perspectives, and that bringing that all together and working together helps our community run, and that even the smallest people, wind turbines, actions can have a really big impact. But I also wanted them to have some curiosity about the world around them and learn new things, like the setting of the port. A lot of children don't know what a port is, so this is an entry point for that. Obviously, wind turbine and wind energy and renewable energy. So I wanted them to look at the world differently, seeing these like ships with eyes and the characterized trains, as well as have some questions about the world around them.
Mm-hmm. It's such a gift to have a book like this that is getting at all those themes, but it's also like in our backyard and all these things that all these kids will definitely recognize. So
there's a couple little Milwaukee nods, wink a nod in the story that definitely Milwaukee readers will recognize.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran speaking with Katie Meyer, the author of Gust, a book for young readers. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Census data shows the population of Milwaukee is dropping. That's why Milwaukee's mayor has a goal of increasing the population to 1 million. We'll explore that trend tomorrow on Lake Effect. Tomorrow is also the start of our Connect, Inspire, Engage member drive. We'll share some of WUWM's award-winning work and the stories that we hope connect, inspire, and engage you. That's all tomorrow on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.